back here this morning. We are going to be waiting for a few people. We probably won't actually wait for them. They'll be bedraggled and entering the back door as we start. But it's great to have people back this morning for what I think will be a very interesting morning. I'm certainly looking forward to it. One of the stimulations for this conference was the discussion that Paul and I had over many years about where the discourse of painting sits in relation to the discourse of digital media, or whatever we can now call it, well, now that it's not new. And so one of the twin parallel issues for us in this conference was to look at the discourse of painting in the context of the remediated image discourse. And so it was with great pleasure that I found in my searches a recent book called Contemporary Painting in Context, which was edited and contributed to by Anne Ring Peterson. And we had communicated about the possibility of her coming to this conference, and we were delighted that she said she could come. She's got about 3 weeks here in Australia, so we're hoping that she can meet a number of people. And she's come in to visit us in Melbourne, so it's great to have you here, Anne. Anne is an associate professor at the Department of Arts and Cultural Studies at the University of Copenhagen. Her primary area of research is visual arts after 1960, and she's contributed to a number of books which are looking at particularly the notion of installation. Installation Art Between Image and Stage in 2009, Images of the City from the Age of Industrialism to the Age of Information in 2002, and The Urban Life World, Formation, Perception and Representation, Performative Realism, and Interdisciplinary Studies in Art and Media in 2005. So I think you can see that she's very much part of our discourse here, and it's a great pleasure for me to welcome Anne to the stage. Thank you.
It's a small advertisement I just insert here before my talk. I'll put it here on the table so you can have a look at it in the break if you want to. So, before starting on my presentation, I'd like to thank the organisers for the honourable invitation to this very interesting conference. It's the first time I visit Sydney and Australia, as Sue mentioned, so I also wish to thank Sue and Paul Thomas for giving me the opportunity to visit this fascinating country and exciting city. In the present phase of globalization, it seems more pertinent than ever to think and work across borders, not only the borders of disciplines and media, but also the borders of institutions, faculties, traditions, and cultures. Thus, the notion of transdisciplinarity and transdisciplinary imaging seems well chosen as tools to open up discussions on art to this kind of relational and transverse thinking. Well, it's not mine. The thematic frame of the conference challenges its speakers to reflect critically on the concept of mediation and, at best, discard it altogether because it has become increasingly normative and doctrinaire, as it is set in the call for papers. This is really a tough nut to crack. To think about visual representations without a concept of mediation is like trying to think about the subject without a concept of identity. Both concepts, mediation and identity, are disputed concepts, but without them, certain key questions can't be thought at all. One way out of this theoretical conundrum is to subject the concept of mediation to a deconstructive critique. Unlike those forms of critique which aim to replace inadequate concepts with truer ones, the deconstructive approach puts key concepts under erasure, to indicate that they are no longer adequate in their originary or unreconstructed form. Is there something wrong with the mic, or is it all right? Okay, fine. ASEAN or other entirely different concepts with which to supplant them, one has to continue to think with them in a deconstructed form that no longer operates within the paradigm in which they originated. Thus, in a deconstructive perspective, the solution is not to discard the concept of mediation together with related concepts of medium and discipline. Instead, we should try to redefine this cluster of concepts, which we can hardly do without when discussing questions concerning art and image making. In the most general terms, mediation and medium refer to the representation and transmission of that special material called meaning by means of a particular channel of communication. In contemporary art historical discourse, medium refers either to the physical materials which constitute artistic expression, or to a group of communicative forms and practices comprising traditional artistic media like painting and photography, as well as mass media like TV and film. Sometimes this discourse operates within older paradigms of disciplinarity and medium specificity. At other times, it draws on the new media discourse in which a medium is often understood to be an apparatus, that is to say, a system of relations or a heterogeneous ensemble of material, technical, institutional, economic, discursive, social and aesthetic elements. To anticipate a later point in my line of argument, I'd like to suggest that Richard Grusin's and J. David Bolter's theory of remediation that Jens Hauser also talked about yesterday offers a deconstructed concept of mediation which enables us to conceive mediation and image making as hybrid and transformative processes rather than as consisting physical materials or mere transmission channels. And so does the concept of transdisciplinary imaging that the conference is offering. I take the latter, the concept of transdisciplinary imaging, to be a kind of non-concept, that is to say, a signifier without a predefined normative signified, or as an as yet undefined concept which the conference speakers are invited to fill with a possible meaning. In this respect, I agree with Roy Ascott, who said in his talk yesterday that the call for papers leaves the term transdisciplinary imaging open to discussion and interpretation. As everyone remotely familiar with Western art will know, painting has for centuries taken up the position as the master discipline in the Western hierarchy of the fine arts. Accordingly, painting was, and to some degree still is, the epitome of artistic disciplinarity. Thanks to modernist art theory, painting has also been regarded as the ideal medium for exploring the means of a discipline, its so-called medium specificity, within the strict limits of the discipline itself. It's perhaps due to this modernist legacy that people have been hesitant to acknowledge that painting has expanded its fields considerably over the last decades. Since the 1960s, painting has increasingly defined itself as an interdisciplinary, expanded field of painting. This expansion has primarily been achieved by means of intermediality and crossovers between various artistic media. It could be between painting and photography, or between painting, This is the painting and sculpture. It could be between painting and the ready-made. Painting and installation art. Or painting and performance, to mention the most common types of intermedial crossovers. The idea of an expanded field originated in Rosalind Krauss's seminal essay, Sculpture in the Expanded Field, from 1978. For Krauss, An expanded field is a ground for exploration and innovative relations and combinations between fundamentally different categories. It's not synonymous with a boundless and eclectic assimilation of new stuff. It's more recent art criticism that has given the term this diluted meaning. According to Krauss, the crucial difference between a discipline and a field is not greater variety of expressions and materials, but the fact that the transformation of the discipline into a field gives the discipline a new set of cultural terms and structural principles with which to work. As a result, the discipline develops a heightened awareness of the interrelations of media, that is, their intermediality. The invention of photography and film in the 19th century spurred a historical development in the course of which painting would eventually lose its leading position in the art as well as in the culture of images at large. As a result, painting entered into a new relationship of exchange to the cultural codes of the technical images and mass media. This is a well-known story, I won't go into this. But since the 1990s, painting has also met the challenge of pondering anew the role of painting in the context of ubiquitous digital media and the mediating functions of the internet. As the German new media artist and theorist Peter Weibel has phrased it, we live in a sea of mediated visuality. I would like to suggest that the transformation of the discipline of painting into an expanded field has not only liberated painting from the restrictions of the classical repertoire of materials and genres, enabling painting to transgress its traditional historical limits. It has also released a tremendous potential for image making that takes painting as a point of departure, but moves far beyond the dialogical limitations of intermedia. I've chosen to approach the issue of painting's potential for transgressing its own disciplinarity by using two theoretical concepts as stepping stones to an apprehension of painting as a transdisciplinary activity, that is, painting defined as a critical remediating process, or, as the title of my paper suggests, painting as remediated painting. I guess some of the works presented by Ian Gwilt yesterday would qualify as remediated paintings in the sense that I'm speaking of it today. The first stepping stone is the idea of painting as pittura in media, developed by Peter Weibel. His essay, Pittura in Media, Painting in the 90s, Between Mediated Visuality and Visuality in Context, from 1995, is one of the most perceptive surveys of the ways in which painting was transformed when artists started to appropriate images and techniques from mechanical and electronic media, and more recently, the computer and the internet. The second stepping stone is the concept of remediation, as it was first suggested and defined by Bolter and Grusin in their book Remediation, Understanding New Media, from 1999. Thus, the overall ambition of this paper is to investigate the critical potential of remediated painting using works by three Northern European artists as testing ground for my argument. In this context, critique has a double meaning. It should be understood to be the self-critique of the disciplinarity of painting and the related notion of autonomous art forms, but it should also be understood as the critique of the democratized visual culture of techno-mediated images. My point is that in remediated painting, the two meanings of critique, self-critique and cultural critique, are interrelated, as demonstrated by the works of the three artists I've chosen as my examples. The first artist is the Dane Torbjørn Laugesen, who started as a painter in the late 60s, moved into kinetic art and electronic sculpture, and then on to what we usually call new media art, although they are not or that new, as Sue suggested in her opening remarks. He's one of the first. He's one of the few Danish artists who has investigated the field between art and technology consistently and in an international context. In the last two decades, he has made a series of data projections based on scientific data. One could perhaps describe this part of his work with the title of the conference series as consisting in a transdisciplinary imaging positioned at the intersections between art, science, and culture. The second artist is the German painter Katharina Grosse. She creates huge site-specific installations, spraying paint on monumental sculptural objects or on the exhibition space itself. In this way, she redefines the very concept of a painting or an image as she transformed the painted artifact into a space or a place that the visitor must enter and pass through. My third example is the British artist David Batchelor, who is also a writer and a graduate of Birmingham's Interdisciplinary Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies. Since the late 1990s, David Batchelor has concentrated on colour in urban environments, and this interest in colours is apparent both from his works and his writings. In 2006, he summed up the ambiguity of his relationship with painting in a way that seems to me to articulate a dilemma that many contemporary artists are confronted with. Quote, "My relationship with painting is ambivalent. I use the term in its strict sense, which is motivated by a simultaneous attraction to it and repulsion from it. I work in a studio, and my work in studios is certainly informed by painting. Even if my work is mainly three-dimensional, and some would call it sculpture, but I don't think I would. Painting still informs it more than anything else. I can't get away from painting entirely. At the same time, I can't do it." Unquote. I've chosen these three artists, firstly, because I consider them to be radical artists that push back the frontiers of painting. Secondly, because they hold very different positions in today's expanded field of painting. Introducing the diversity of this field by way of a few examples doesn't enable me to cover the whole spectrum, but hopefully to uncover some important strands of transdisciplinarity. To simplify, in order to clarify, one could say that Lauston's approach is constructivist, Grosse's approach is phenomenological, and Batchelor's take on painting is materialist. I'll come back to the artists and their works later, but for now, I pick up my theoretical line of argument by returning to my first stepping stone, Peter Weibel. Peter Weibel fuses the words immediate and mediation into the word or neologism immediation to describe what happens when various kinds of technical images are integrated in a painterly practice. Following Weibel's definition, immediation refers to a process of traveling through a number of different media which results in a painting in the widest sense of the word, that rearticulates the question of the nature of the visual and the image, with an emphasis on its mediated, coded, and contextual nature. Post-medial painting, as Peter Weibel also labels this kind of second-order painting, reacts immediately to the media as phenomena of the empirical world. It aims at transcending them in order to pave the way for a transformed spontaneity of the second order. Thus, post-medial painting is, quote, "not painting as underbidding the media, but as outbidding them, moving beyond," unquote. Peter Weibel defines immediation as a dynamic and transformative process of channeling. This understanding of mediation seems very close to the concept of remediation introduced in the discourses on new media only a few years later by Bolter and Grusin. Symptomatically, the two media theorists don't refer to Bible's theory of painting and immediation, despite the fact that they often refer to painting as a medium of historical importance. Since the mid-1990s, new media and ICT have become important forces for creative culture and economic development. Supporting institutions such as Ars Electronica, the ZKM and iBeam that position themselves at the intersections of art, science and technology have also expanded. Simultaneously, mainstream contemporary art has experienced a dramatic growth propelled by the proliferation of venues like art fairs and biennials, and by the creativity of artists, curators, dealers and critics. However, as these two art worlds rarely meet, except on conferences like this, their discourses have increasingly diverged. As a result, their discourses seldom deal with the question to what extent new media art and mainstream contemporary art are commensurable. Hence, my presentation is a modest contribution to the construction of a hybrid discourse that offers insight into each and at the same time enables a greater exchange between them. Bolter and Grusin developed their theory of remediation as a response to the pervasive conviction among new media critics that the representational power of the computer and its associated digital technology must be fundamentally different from earlier technologies, especially from television and film. In Remediation, the two authors refute this digital essentialism of other new media critics and argue that, like all media introduced in the last two centuries, digital media depended for the cultural meaning on the context of older media forms from which they emerged. The theory of remediation explains how a new medium refashions a predecessor in the sense that it reforms and improves a predecessor on the level of content as well as form, while still being marked by the presence of the older medium in either acknowledged or unacknowledged ways. This is particularly clear in the CD-ROM multimedia with its mosaic of other media. It's also visible in the windowed style of the graphical user interface in which different programs representing different media can appear in each window. Bolter and Grusin also explores how a new medium subjects its predecessor to what they call a repurposing, the idea being that a new medium borrows from an older medium in order to fulfill a new purpose. For example, when broadcast television is transformed into interactive digital television in order to motivate and engage viewers. The term remediation has also been included in the discourses on contemporary art, where it's often construed as a historical progression or even evolution in which recent media refashion older ones in order to fulfill new purposes or reach other audiences. It's mostly used to describe how digital art refashions its predecessors. For instance, when artists such as the Italian artist duo Eva and Franco Mattis use online worlds like Second Life to stage their works. In their series of so-called synthetic performances, Eva and Franco Mattis used their avatars to reenact a number of historical performances by well-known artists in Second Life. Bolter and Grusin's concept of remediation is actually rather broad and comprises four different meanings. In addition to the two I have already touched upon, refashioning and repurposing, remediation can also mean representing, in the sense that a new medium can represent an older medium. For example, when a website offers pictures or texts for users to download. A fourth definition is that new media borrow from older media, like when a painting incorporates a motif from an older painting. Following this line of thought, Picasso's paraphrases of Velázquez's Las Meninas would be a remediation, and so would most of what is known as stage photography. The two last definitions are of minor relevance to the issue of transdisciplinarity and transdisciplinary imaging. Moreover, they don't really add anything to what has for decades been framed theoretically by concepts such as representation, paraphrase, and appropriation. As Bolt and Grusin point out, their theory of remediation is, quote, a genealogy of affiliations, not a linear history, and in this genealogy, older media can also remediate newer ones, unquote. The last observation is part of an argument that eventually turns the author's idea of remediation in digital media into a general idea about all media. Thus, Bolter and Grusin asserts that, quote, all mediation is remediation, unquote. They add that they don't mean this in the sense that this should be a universal truth. Their observation applies to a specific historical situation created by the wealth of possibilities of remediation emerging with digital information technology. Bolter and Grusin claim that as remediation has developed into a general cultural condition, it also offers us a means of reinterpreting the work and discourses of older media, like, for instance, painting. The authors don't pursue this line of inquiry apart from adding a causal explanation. While new technologies of representation proceed by reforming their predecessors, older media struggle to maintain their legitimacy, as they called it, by remediating newer ones. Thus, according to the two media theorists, innovation comes from new media, whereas older media can only struggle to maintain what is already there. As we shall see, contemporary painting proves them wrong. Nevertheless, the theory of remediation opens up the possibility that we could imagine the remediation process in reverse. So, what happens if we understand remediation not only as new media using old media, but also as something that older media can do with newer ones? This would not only draw attention to the speed with which new media forms get assimilated into already existing cultures. It would also, and this is far more interesting, enable us to understand and recognize that a medium that continues to function as an apparatus for image making is not frozen in time. It remains a dynamic medium that contributes to the refashioning and repurposing of image making. I would like to suggest that we can give more exact descriptions of what happens when a painting is cross-fertilized with more recent media if we conceive of the vaguely defined expanded field of painting as remediated painting. This would amount to a return to Rosalind Krauss's definition of an expanded field, but under a new name, which reflects the huge impact of new digital media in contemporary culture. Now then, what is to be gained from this reconceptualization of the expanded field of painting as remediated painting? Firstly, it introduces a concept of painting that starts from the transdisciplinary potential of painting instead of its historical disciplinarity and the attendant assumption that, as a discipline, painting functions independently and establishes its own separate sphere of cultural meaning. Secondly, it conceptualizes painting as an active, performative, and migrant participant in the cultural, commercial, and scientific contexts in which it is embedded. It suggests that contemporary painting is active as a cultural force, not just as so-called autonomous fine art. The term remediated painting suggests that painting has become a transdiscipline or a travelling medium that moves between or into a range of different media, refashioning and repurposing these media as well as painting. It follows that remediated painting is also synonymous with the process of becoming painting rather than with a firmly established state of being painting and maintaining what is already there without creating anything new. The claim that painting, so often declared dead and obsolete, is active as a cultural force, of course, needs to be substantiated. As the British painter Joan Key has pointed out, IT screens are not paint, and yet they are pictorial, and the vocabulary of abstract painting has participated in devising their visual language by, quote, generating recognition for groupings and sequences of planes and edges in superimposition, unquote. Drawing on John Roberts' book, The Intangibilities of Form, Skill and Deskilling in Art After the Ready-Made, Key locates the origin of this interface between painting and IT screen in early modernist painting. She makes clear that abstract modernist painting wasn't only about medium specificity and essentialism as it became during and after the Second World War. Around and after the time of the First World War, visual abstraction was a potent response to the needs of industrialization. Artists such as Alexander Rodchenko and the Soviet productivists, Joseph Appers, Paul Klee, and other Bauhaus school teachers saw painterly abstraction as a communicable, transdisciplinary, formal response, and they developed a non-figurative language that was also adapted in graphic design and industrial production. My point is that the diffusion of modern artistic techniques into what John Roberts calls the general social techniques of productive labor has quite a long history. With the spread of IT screens, the question of the transmissibility of painting into other media has become topical again. In this context, the role of painting as a general social technique doesn't depend so much on the material nature of the traditional painted object, the oil paint and the canvas, or the acrylic paint and the canvas. It's rather a question of visuality and sensation. As Joan Key puts it, quote, what is it in the immediate, material, sensuous being with painting that can be re-given as sensation rather than image, unquote. To approach this question, it's helpful to turn to some examples of what I have chosen to call remediated painting. In what follows, I'll primarily concentrate on Torbjørn Lausten. I'll focus on how he situates himself at the intersections between art, science, and culture. I'm particularly interested in how he uses scientific data to approach the classical question of the relation of art to reality and of culture to nature in a new way. It is indeed his inclusion of scientific data that enables him to ask critical questions concerning the boundaries between aesthetics, knowledge, science, and technology. To call Lausten's data visualizations paintings would be misleading. Conversely, you risk missing the point if you ignore that painting, historically the privileged medium of imagination, is crucial to the meaning of his work. It is this connection to the apparatus and aesthetics of painting that account for their intended effect on the audience. I would like to show a very short video clip to give you a mediated impression of the immediate sensory effect of his work. It's from his exhibition Magnet, which could be viewed simultaneously at ZKM, also known as the Center for Arts and Media in Karlsruhe, and two Danish art institutions. It contained visualizations of magnetism and infrared radiation, that is something that's basically invisible. The projected images were based on continuous data streams received via the internet from a geostationary satellite covering four geographical areas. So, Larsen's data visualizations are dynamic images, as you could see from this short video clip. They are dynamic images that undergo transformation in real time. His works don't consist of images, but rather perform systems of relations in which data is transformed into images by means of algorithms and information technology. In this process, his systems of relations become visual systems accessible to the senses. On several occasions, Larsen has collaborated closely with scientists like the Danish astrophysicist Ib Lundgaard Rasmussen. Together they created NOW, the Polar Space, which is one of Larsen's most encompassing projects. A leitmotif of Larsen's work is the use of scientific data to create metaphors for the way knowledge and information about reality is transformed into images based on digital data. Larsen's view of scientific visualization... Well, what happened there? Continue from there. Larsen's view of scientific visualization is explicitly constructivist. Hence, his visualizations don't depict reality in the sense that they are mimetic images of the visual world. On the contrary, they're critical explorations of how contemporary science increasingly makes use of visualizations to make a complex reality comprehensible. The main reason for the growing importance of scientific visualizations is that scientists have to deal with a huge amount of data and the emergence of complex issues which can barely be understood unless given a visual form. Well-known examples of this are, of course, medical imaging and the fractal geometry used for mathematical simulation of clouds, waves, flowers, and other natural phenomena. Such visualizations have paved the way for a new convergence of art and science, the cognitive and the sensory realms. The aim of NOW, the Polar Space, from 1996, was to create a visual Arctic space. The installation consisted of 10 large computer-programmed wall projections of geometric images. And I'm sorry that the quality of my image isn't any better, but it's because it's a project that's more than 10 years old, so I haven't got anything better than this. The data had been collected by means of different kinds of technical equipment for measuring and observation, and it had entered into the project from different channels. Most of the data came from Copenhagen-based research institutes working on polar projects, mainly in Greenland. The input was used to program the content of each individual image and to determine the sequence of each projection. The projections visualized different phenomena: magnetism, the geological formation of Greenland as a landmass, variations in the tides and ocean currents, and an analysis of the Greenland ice core revealing climate changes during the past 200,000 years. There were also visualizations of the ongoing changes of the weather and the ozone layer, and changes in flora and fauna, and the migration of narwhals and polar bears. The phenomena and events spanned timescales ranging from a few seconds to 4.5 billion years, and they ranged from data transmitted directly to the exhibition via satellite and the internet to data deriving from the creation of the Earth. The size of the phenomena displayed varied from individual animals and plants within a few square meters of Arctic nature to the movement of the polar ice across the entire ice cap. Consequently, time and space were relative to the phenomenon that the projection visualized. Taken together, the projections constituted a sort of data sum, that is, an accumulation of data represented as a computer-generated Arctic reality. As the transformation rules were not displayed, viewers could not read the data values off the screens and gain any factual knowledge about Arctic nature. The visualizations presented themselves to the eye as animated abstract paintings. As a matter of fact, Lausen's intention was not to produce scientific illustrations and inform his audience about Greenland. Visitors at the exhibition venue in Copenhagen didn't see polar space. They experienced a displacement between two contexts, between Greenland as the source of data and the installation as the source of the images. This displacement or decoupling of the two contexts raised the critical question of the nature and status of scientific visualizations by demonstrating that data are not indisputable facts, but something people, in this case scientists, interpret and construct, and that these data don't exist independently of a medium or a channel of information. Moreover, the installation also made it clear that scientific visualizations are not only science, but also an aesthetic practice, based on the transdisciplinary language of visual abstraction. According to Lausen, we have an obligation to investigate their function and make up our knowledge. Art has a special stake in this exploration of scientific visualizations. On the one hand, art partakes in the construction of knowledge and visualizations, but on the other hand, art can also act as a critical investigator of these constructions. As Lausen has put it, quote, "I don't think it's any exaggeration to claim that art constitutes our knowledge. In this connection, art is not to be understood in terms of those kinds of platitudes popular among the general public, but ought to be related to the term techne in its original meaning." Unquote. To sum up, Lausen redefines his work as an artist rooted in painterly abstraction by linking art to techne, that is, the ancient Greek concept of cultural activity as comprising craftsmanship as well as the disciplines later renamed art. In Lausen's project Magnet and Now the Polar Space, a painter's imagination and the formal means of systemic painting are cross-fertilized with techniques of scientific imaging. The resulting remediated paintings presented themselves to the eye as computer visualizations imbued with aesthetic painterly qualities such as exquisite luminous color schemes and aesthetically pleasing compositions. I would say that this is not an intermediate hybrid of painting and computer images in the tradition from Rauschenberg's and Warhol's silkscreen paintings and Peter Weibel's Pittura Immedia. Lausen accomplishes something else. His analysis of how scientists construct images of the empirical world by using computer technology reinvents painting as a kind of meta-critique of scientific discourses and imaging. In recent years, a remarkable number of painters have begun to explore the possibility of developing painting in the opposite direction of digital virtual spaces. Today, much of the experimental energy is put into exploring the physical and tangible spatiality of painting. Artists are investigating painting's relations to objects, to space, to place, and what we sometimes call the everyday. In doing so, they're remediating painting through more recent art forms like the ready-made, site-specific art, and installation art. The techniques of installation art have added a wide range of expressions to the palette of artists such as Katharina Grosse, who uses the spatiality of installation art to translate painting from plane to space and wrap the work around the viewer as a three-dimensional environment. Thus, her works elicit the more bodily and performative type of response typical of installation art. One could say that she creates a usually temporary stage-like event, and that this event, or spatial situation, gives substance to the dream that illusionistic paintings have always played on. The dream of literally walking into the painting in order to explore it more thoroughly and empathize more deeply with it. Grosse accomplishes a refashioning and repurposing of painting by integrating the physical world in her works. She uses the space of buildings, walls, partitions, floors as painting surfaces, and sometimes also physical objects and the materiality of soil. In this way, she involves the visitor intensely on the sensory and bodily, as well as on the cognitive level. In 2009, she made a site-specific long-term installation that transformed the 150-meter-long art axis at the Museum Arken outside Copenhagen into a brightly colored imaginary world. The exhibition was entitled "Hello, Little Butterfly, I Love You, What's Your Name?" and was the second in a series of three exhibitions on the topic of utopia. Grosse-type paintings, sculptures, and large mounds of earth, together with monumental site-specific paintings, executed directly on walls and floors so that the solids of architecture dissolved into optical illusions. The installation offered the visitor the joy of going away, of leaving grayness and entering color. As a celebration of the escape, it could be seen as a physical staging of a basic utopian impulse, the desire for something else, the desire for elsewhere. By means of visual abstraction, atmospheric color effects, elliptical and rectangular paintings, earth and rock-like sculptures, the installation constructed a possible universe where the experience of shifting between changing pictorial levels blurred the boundary between physical and imaginary space. As Maria Lauerberg, the curator of Grosse's exhibition, has pointed out, quote, "We are not in one or the other, but in both at the same time. We are in a space between the actual space of our surroundings and a dreamlike world of possibility, conception, and fantasy," unquote. For her paintings, Katharina Grosse uses a standard tool of house painters and graffiti artists, the mechanized brush of the spray gun. Contrary to house painters and graffiti artists, she paints with very good pigments, thus bringing together the sphere of fine arts and the everyday. She uses the spray gun as a mediating device that introduces a cool distance between the hand of the painter and the surfaces she paints. She also uses the spray gun as a means to enlarge the gesture of the hand, making the gestures bigger and more powerful than the physique of the human body would allow. Thus, what the spray gun leaves is more than life-size traces of a body moving in space and time. It's macro imprints of a painter's performance. In that sense, you could say that these are performative works or works with a performative dimension. As a result, her installations emphasize technical and mechanical mediation, while at the same time giving priority to the haptic and bodily qualities of sensation that are so often excluded from the visual experience by the slickness of many techno-mediated images. Returning to Peter Weibel's thoughts on immediation, one could say that Gross's remediated painting introduces an overwhelming, vibrant materialism capable of outbidding the sensory impact of both easel painting and installation art, because it enables the visitor, because it engages the visitor intensely on a phenomenological level. Skeptics would perhaps argue that Gross's work is simply too beautiful and too pleasurable to be critical too. But this judgment would ignore the fact that we are simultaneously attracted to and repelled from very strong, raw colours such as those of Gross's. It would also fail to see the way she destabilizes the habitual perception of easel painting. While drifting through an installation, the visitor's point of view is shifting with the movement, which means that there's no right way of looking at the spatial situation. The privileged, centered viewing position offered by easel painting has been eliminated and the viewer set in motion in more than one sense. As opposed to graffiti, with which her work is sometimes compared, Gross's work is not about making claims on certain areas, taking possession of them. On the contrary, she invites the visitor to trespass, to walk into, even to walk on the painting. Thus, it's more about making the visitor feel the freedom involved in trespassing than about marking borders. Crossing borders is also essential to David Batchelor. He's an artist with a double involvement. On the one hand, he makes interventions into the everyday and engages with a multitude of ready-mades found in urban environments. On the other, he's deeply engaged in a painterly exploration of colour, especially the monochrome, a cornerstone of modernist painting. The two types of engagement intersect in Batchelor's suite of found monochromes, begun in 1997. Now and then, Batchelor would drift through London, stopping to take photographs of monochromes in situ. Batchelor's photographs capture single, square, and rectangle planes of uninterrupted white. They're informal, and they're shot from a uniform distance so that the white planes are seen on different backdrops: brick walls, car doors, metal fences, and more. In this way, Batchelor demonstrates how the monochrome can be a ready-made and highlights how it's sided or embedded in our daily environment. The ready-made is perhaps the most common means of remediation in modern art. Artists have combined painting and sculpture with ready-made elements to refashion these media ever since Picasso made his first collage, Still Life with Chair Caning, in 1912. Moreover, the ready-made is a reminder that the artist never starts from a tabula rasa. There's always something there already. In Batchelor's works, this something that is always already there is globalized consumer culture. His physical material is often objects that are colorful and luminous in and of themselves. This preference for colored, mass-produced objects is a token of the interest he takes in the way our experience of color has been transformed in the past 100 years, primarily through electrification and petrochemicals. In 2007, he created the installation Unplugged, consisting of 23 hairy columns or trees made from thousands of cheap, brightly colored plastic things bought in pound shops in London, Edinburgh, Glasgow, and Sharjah in the United Arab Emirates. These plastic clips, toys, cutlery, toilet brushes, and feather dusters were all made in China, but distributed worldwide thanks to today's global economical exchange. Batchelor's artificial wood of plastic trees pointed to the visual splendor of our everyday objects, but also to the almost repulsive garishness and chromatic flatness that surrounds us at all times in urban environments, and to the aesthetic homogenization brought about by globalized consumer culture. Lauston points to the aesthetic and chromatic qualities of scientific visualizations and invites the viewer to reflect critically on the reliability of their constructed truth. Grosse makes painting an integral part of the physical environment that people move in, attempting to open our eyes to the freedom of trespassing. Last but not least, Batchelor explores how the primary material of painting, color, is omnipresent in everyday experience, where it transcends all disciplinary borders and creates its own symbolic and aesthetic orders. I think it would be an exaggeration to call their work criticism in the strong political and moralistic sense of the word. These artists are critical in the sense that they take a fresh and thoughtful revisionist look at things that we have grown accustomed to and simply take for granted. The art historian and cultural theorist Irit Rogoff has introduced a very useful distinction between three types of critical engagement. The first type is criticism, understood as a form of finding faults and allocating and exercising judgment according to a consensus of values. The second type is critique, understood as the analysis of underlying assumptions, sort of bringing the underlying assumptions to light. And the third is what she calls criticality. And criticality is interesting in this context. According to Rogoff, criticality operates from what she calls an uncertain ground of actual embeddedness. That is, it operates from a desire to inhabit culture and to participate in culture in a relation that is different from the critical analysis that intends to illuminate flaws and allocate blames. Lauston, Grosse, and Batchelor practice criticality as defined by Rogoff. They wish to inhabit contemporary visual culture, and they know that this is also the only thing one can do considering the ubiquity of techno-mediated images. As Peter Weibel points out, we live in a sea of mediated visuality. Thank you.